Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you, Scott. Hi, everybody. Here's what's ahead. Texas puts its reopening plans on pause as COVID cases rise. We'll have the latest on that. Plus, a new concern bubbling up in the markets. Joe Biden's rise in the polls. We'll have the numbers and what it means for investors. Speaking of hitting pause, beleaguered Disney is facing new challenges with reopening delays and movie pushbacks. We'll have those details and the impact on this underperforming stock. Plus, a big win for the banks, putting the market in supermarket and the college campus quandary. That's all ahead today. But we do begin with these volatile markets. Dom Chu here with that run through for us.
Dom. All right. So, Kelly, it's a bit of a pause overall right now as well, because we've seen both red and green today. But overall, you're seeing just some fractional, very fractional gains in the Dow, the S&P 500, and NASDAQ. The Dow Industrials were up 143 points at the highs so far today, up 57 still, though. Those marginal gains holding, the S&P 500 still above its longer-term 200-day moving average or average price longer-term over the last 200 days. And the NASDAQ composite really holding steady as well, up about 0.25%. One place to watch, though, is the negativity that's playing out in certain retailers that have had nice runs. But if the COVID pandemic is really going to surge again, will some of these retailers do pretty poorly, relatively speaking? Ross Stores on the discount side, Tapestry, you can see down 3%, Kohl's down 4%, and Gap Stores down 3% as well. Watch some of these brick and mortar heavy retailers as well. And then the COVID stock of this particular era has been Zoom in the past, but has been Fastly as of late. This is a company that helps accelerate internet content to users. That company is up 8% again. And believe it or not, go back down to here. This was a $14 stock thereabouts back at the COVID lows. Look at where it is right now, almost $82. So we'll call it roughly 485%, Kelly, returns just in a few months. Fastly, a big move higher here.
That is wild. They're an IPO, Dom. They're a pandemic stock. They've got it. And they're called Fastly. They've got it all.
They check a lot of boxes, yeah. For sure.
We'll see you later, Dom. Thanks very much. Now, as COVID cases do surge across the country, states, cities, and counties are reevaluating their reopening plans, especially Texas. The governor announcing just a short while ago that new phases of reopening the state's economy will be halted. We're also getting some headlines from the CDC briefing that's just wrapping up. For all the latest, let's go straight to Meg Terrell. Meg.
Hey, Kelly. Well, let's start with that CDC briefing. The remarks just coming just now from the call that just ended. The CDC director really taking a different tone than we've perhaps heard from Dr. Fauci in the hearing earlier this week, saying we're in a very different position now in the pandemic than we were in March and April. Now, he said he is not underplaying the significance of these new cases, but he did point out that many of the new cases are in younger people who he said, quote, in the past, I don't think we diagnosed these infections. He said that from the CDC's perspective, only 110 to 120 counties in the U.S. are considered hotspots or having significant transmission, pointing out that's just about 3% of the counties in the United States. Now, we also noted that the CDC has been doing ongoing surveillance of antibodies using blood samples to try to tell who's been exposed to the virus. And he said they estimate now that 5 to 8% of the American public has experienced infection, whether they recognized it or not. They may have been asymptomatic. He said that some states that were less hard hit could have prevalence of under 2%, whereas areas like the New York area that was harder hit would have fewer susceptibles. So perhaps higher number of those with antibodies. He said that the CDC currently estimates 10 people have antibodies for every one case. Now, he did reiterate he's not downplaying the risk and that we could see a follow-on increase in hospitalizations and deaths within 3 to 4 weeks. And part of the risk of younger people getting infected and those who don't know that they're sick is that they could pass it on to more susceptible people. But Kelly, this happening as, of course, we're seeing these headlines from Texas about the state pausing its reopening where it is and in four counties that are extremely hard hit, telling hospitals that they can't do elective surgeries to make sure that they have capacity. capacity for COVID-19 patients. This is, we're seeing headlines for Houston that they are exceeding their ICU capacity. So quite concerning, but the CDC director saying a very different situation now from back in March. Kelly?
Meg, are they doing anything to try to link or not link the surge in young people in some of these hotspots to the protests over the past month or so or not? I mean, did they say anything about whether those two are related?
No commentary on the call about protests, although they weren't specifically asked about that. In terms of the advice that they're giving people, including for the upcoming July 4th holiday weekend, is social distancing is the number one thing people need to do, hand washing and mask wearing. But no, they weren't asked about protests. Interestingly, we are hearing from California. They think that the protests may have contributed to some of the uptick, but in Massachusetts, they don't. And of course, these are areas of the country that have dramatically different levels of transmission right now.
Yeah, absolutely. One more quick thing on the situation in Houston. You know, the heads of the hospitals down there are saying they have surge capacity. But when you see a headline which says that their ICUs are at capacity today, I mean, if this case count keeps rising, I would hope and assume that surge capacity is ready to go.
Yeah, I mean, the reports coming out of Houston, the Texas Medical Center, show that their surveillance is very strong. The data shows that they're looking at this and they are preparing for it. But, you know, that's why we're seeing these warnings, because they have such surveillance and they're putting out this information showing when they're reaching capacity. So concerning situation for them, certainly.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Meg, thanks very much. Meg Terrell with all of the headlines on that front. In the meantime, Democratic presidential contender Joe Biden building on his lead over President Trump on all issues, pretty much except one. Steve Leisman is here now with the results of the latest CNBC All-America Economic Survey. Steve?
Kelly, thanks. Yeah, the CNBC All-America Economic Survey showing that Joe Biden has jumped out to a 9-point lead, increasing it by 4 points from our April survey. If you look at the data, what you see is that the president lost just a point, but it was Biden who gained another 3 points in the survey. And the reason is he consolidated his base. Democrats increased their support for the president. Young people, maybe some of those Bernie supporters moved over, along with certain income groups as well. The president lost some support among independents, also lost some support among older people. Looking at the issues, though, the president does lead on the critical issue of the economy. We asked about 8 specific issues. The president, however, leading on just one. He has a 6-point lead when we ask who has the best policies on the economy. But he doesn't lead on 2 marquee issues. It's within the margin of error on immigration and border security, as well as dealing with China. Biden has a very slight lead. And as you move to the right on issues like foreign policy and world leadership, the critical issue of health care and COVID, and even racial equality, Joe Biden has a commanding lead on those issues. Looking at the economy, what we find is that 26% of respondents say they've lost wages, salary, or hours at work. 9% say they've lost their job. 77% think a second wave is likely. And 46% are concerned their state could open too fast, compared to 30% who say too soon. And one more look here. When will business return to normal? 64% say a year or longer. So, Kelly, while the economic numbers are tough right now and the outlook is still very uncertain, the president still has that lead on the economy, though Biden leads overall.
How consequential is the loss of some independent support, Steve?
You know, it's potentially consequential, but if you look at what happened, Kelly, it's a fascinating story. The president lost 11 percentage points in support from independents, but they didn't go over to Biden. They went over into the undecided column. So our Republican and Democratic pollsters who we have on this poll say, you know what? Those folks are still up for grabs here. The idea that Biden didn't capture them means that potentially they could go back to the president, depending upon what happens. Still a long way to go. Nobody's ruling anybody out in this election, Kelly.
Oh, it's early, that's for sure. But still a big swing there. Steve, thanks very much. We appreciate it. Steve Leisman. So which is the bigger risk to the markets? Is it the rise of Biden in the polls? Is it the rise of COVID cases across the country? Let's talk about it with Sandy Villery, who's co-portfolio manager of the Villery Balanced Fund, and Michael Yoshikami, who is founder and CEO of Destination Wealth Management. Welcome to both of you. Michael, I'll turn to you first, especially kind of curious how this plays into a lot of your themes, which are, I know, healthcare, technology to some extent. Are these areas you think can do well regardless?
Yeah, it depends on what time frame you're talking about, Kelly. I think that what we're looking at here is you have to look past 12 months. Over the next 3 or 6 months, everything could potentially have problems, particularly if we have the slope of the virus. So it's all about time horizon. Healthcare, I think, is going to get a pass to make a lot of money to do biotech research. So we think that's an opportunity. And obviously, technology continues to be a bigger part of the economy. So it all depends on time frame. As I said in the notes that we sent over to you, I think it's entirely possible we're going to see a 10% correction like now, imminently. We already have seen softness in the market, even though it's stabilized today. I just don't think that you're going to get away from virus related panic selling.
What about the politics, Michael? You know, would a Biden presidency, what if there's, you know, not a divided Congress? In other words, Democratic-controlled Congress. I mean, what would that do for you from an investment point of view?
Well, first of all, I think that if there's any change, a change in administration, legislative bodies, it's going to be a net negative volatility issue for the markets. But I think sometimes people somewhat overstate how much presidential politics necessarily play into this. Remember when Donald Trump was elected? I remember on the day Donald Trump was elected, I was on network with Tyler in the middle of the night, and the market was down, I think, 10% just based on that one election night swing. So I don't think you can put too much into it because, really, Kelly, the money that's inserted into the system combined with what the Federal Reserve is doing, that's really going to be a tailwind for the economy for a significant period of time.
All right. Sandy, let me bring you in on that and, you know, talk through some of the trends that you see playing out here. What are the most important ones? Do you also think you have to kind of, I mean, it's easy to say you have to look past the near-term volatility, but we know for a fact that things are going to swing around. So as it relates to COVID, as it relates to, you know, Biden's odds, what are you most focused on?
Yeah, Kelly, this is the new normal. I mean, you're going to see fits and starts. You know, I guess yesterday you saw in Texas and Florida and California just the number of cases spiking, and you're going to see the market sell off on that. But I do think this is the new normal. We're going to live with this virus, I think, for some time. If there's something like a vaccine that gets hyped up, I think that's probably an opportunity to take profits and things if the market rallies into that news. And I would be buying individual stocks on a lot of pessimism, like maybe we saw yesterday and a little bit today. Now the market's, you know, recovered a little bit. So as far as the election goes, yeah, that's going to be just going to create more volatility. I think there's some studies that came out that said when you switch from a Republican to a Democrat in the first 3 months, you know, maybe the market sells off a little bit. But I believe in earnings and individual companies, and that's going to rule the day in the long run.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting you say here, while Amazon and Microsoft are the most dominant companies on Earth, you'd rather own a small-cap undiscovered stock that has the ability to double in 3 to 4 years. And some of your picks are eHealth, pharmaceutical name Eldorado, which is keyed to the reopening. Are you feeling a little more concerned about Eldorado now? Or?
Yeah, Eldorado is still down about 50-60% from its highs. And so, yeah, this is one where you've got to believe that the economy is not going to come to a screeching halt. But even in a phase two scenario where things are sort of at 50%, I think these guys will do extremely well. They're getting ready to gobble up Caesars, and that should be closing, you know, end of this month, beginning of July. And while they were talking originally about $500 million in synergies, now they're talking about $850 million in synergies. And there's little things like they closed the buffet at 52 properties that cost them $3 million a year. It's $150 million in savings. So I think there's a lot of things that they're going to come through, and that should be okay. And I like the other picks as well. Ligand is a pharmaceutical company that just is kind of sells the drug delivery technology, sort of the picks and shovels to these biotech companies. And I think that's going to be, do really well. They're selling Captisol to Gilead for their remdesivir treatment for COVID. And they just ramped up their capacity from 60 metric tons to about 500 metric tons. So I think that one's going to do well pre-COVID, you know, during the pandemic and post-COVID.
Yeah, and so then eHealth, buying health insurance online. No, this is the second time now I've heard how much closing the buffet is going to save these casino companies. It's great to have you both here. Sandy Villery, Michael Yoshikami, we do appreciate it. Thanks. The results of the 7-year Treasury auction are out, and we just set a new record. Rick Santelli has that for us. Rick?
Hey. Notes and bonds are exciting. Yes, record setting. 41 billion 7-year notes. Never had an auction that big. And the yield at this Dutch auction, 0.511. The lowest yield ever for a 7-year at auction. Now, the low closing yield in the secondary market has been 0.476. And that was April 21st. Now, let's go through it. all the numbers, the metrics, the bid to cover, indirects, directs, they were all at or above average. Dealers take a lot less than they normally do by a couple of percent. Maybe the best thing of all was where it priced. That 0.511 was on the offer side of the when issued market. Everything was strong. B plus, boy plus on the last of the supply. And it is affected, of course, by the recent volatility in equities. Made the bidders a little bit more aggressive. Kelly, back to you.
That is impressive. Biggest ever and the lowest yield ever. Don't usually go hand in hand. But those are the times we're in. Rick, thanks. Rick Santelli. Coming up, it's life after COVID. Morgan Stanley laying out the four ways this pandemic could play out. What are they and which one is most likely? That's next. And financials are the second worst performing sector this year, but today they're getting a boost. Details of the new regulatory changes that have investors buying. We're back after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
One in eight. That's how many people have worked at a McDonald's. Who serve millions the best Big Mac and best birthday party they've ever had. Who haven't just seen kids graduate from a Happy Meal, but have gotten help graduating themselves. Because they know the skills learned here.
Bienvenidos. Welcome to English Under the Arches.
Can help you grow from here or keep growing here.
Hi, welcome to
One in eight start at McDonald's. And where you start stays with you.
Welcome back. It's a big day for the banks. The KBE Bank ETF is up about 2% right now as bank regulators unveil changes to the Volcker Rule. But it's been a tough year for the industry. Financials, the market's second worst performer, down 24%. Wells Fargo is down 51% from its 52-week high still. Citigroup is down about 37% from that. Bank of America, down 32% as well from its 52-week high. Wilfred Frost joins me now with some positive news for the banks. Wilf?
They're up today. Some good news, as you said. So the two things really driving that move higher today. Firstly, the Volcker Rule's covered funds provision is being adapted, largely as was proposed back in January. This will allow banks to take stakes in private equity and hedge funds. They still will not, though, be able to trade for their own accounts, known as prop trading. The second change, a little more surprising, is that the FDIC and the OCC will no longer require banks to hold margin when trading derivatives with their affiliates, other than for exceptionally large derivative trades. Martin Grunberg of the FDIC opposed both changes. The FDIC voted 3-1 in favor. The Volcker Rule change has been ratified by the SEC and CFTC. The margin change still needs approval from the Fed as well. Investment banks have led that intraday rebound for the bank stocks today. They have the most to gain from these changes, but all the banks are higher. By less, though, than they were down yesterday. So not a massive move in that regard. The timing of these announcements, a little odd, coming the same day as the stress test results, which are due at 4:30 p.m. Eastern time, though we won't get most of the detail until next week when the banks make public what they are told by the Fed this afternoon, Kelly.
Wilf, I'm just curious if these Volcker Rule changes are really that substantive or not. I mean, are they the kind that are boring but substantive, or the kind that sound like a big move but actually don't go that far?
Mainly the former, i.e. not that substantive, if I think I got the order right there. particularly the change to covered funds, and that was also relatively well flagged. Not holding margin against swaps and derivative trades is helpful, and it will free up capital for the banks. But again, to see all the regional banks rally, for example, today versus, you know, more understandable moves in Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, is a little bit of a surprise to see all of them up. But again, you could frame it a totally different way to say they've split the difference of how much they fell yesterday. So not a massive rally in that sense.
All right. That's helpful. Wilfred, thank you. We'll see you later. Wilfred Frost on the bank moves. It's been a tough year to get a good feel for the economy. On the one hand, the jobs picture is bleak, and now more places are pressing pause on reopening. On the other hand, housing is strong, durable goods orders jump, spending is rebounding, and cars are flying off of lots. Morgan Stanley says there are four possible outcomes for this post-COVID economy. Joining me now to talk about which is most likely is Ellen Zentner, chief U.S. economist at Morgan Stanley. Ellen, it's great to have you back. Welcome.
Yeah, hi, Kelly.
So it's basically a robust recovery, back to normal, a new normal, and deep scars. All right, let's hear it. Which one do you think is most likely?
Yeah, so what we're calling a new normal most closely resembles our base case. And, of course, how the vaccine plays out in all of these scenarios is very important to driving which scenario we end up finding ourselves in, because the next 18 months is going to dictate the next 5 years for the economy. So, you know, and what we're calling a new normal is that the vaccine does come in the spring, but not before there's a second wave of infections that does drive some risk aversion during that time. So it leaves a little bit more lasting imprint of risk aversion on consumers and businesses. And so that in that recovery, it's more gradual than, say, some of the more bullish scenarios. But that, return to what we're calling a new normal, importantly, has to come with some assumptions of what does work from home look like. You know, certainly the work from home arrangements will be lower than today, but higher than they were previously. And then how are we incorporating, accelerating technology trends? And that's where the help of our equity analysts became very important in this analysis, because not all is bad when we think about technological advances, especially when they're tied from working from home. Many of those can actually drive productivity gains,
sure,
which in this baseline help us maintain potential GDP.
Right. That would be a sort of good longer-term outcome. So just so everybody is kind of following here, of the four potential outcomes, you're basically thinking kind of the second worst is your base case, which is to say it's not, you know, the worst outcome, but it's not some of the more optimistic ones either. And as you said, a lot of this depends on the vaccine timing. But I really thought it was interesting, your point about how in your base case, which is, you know, somewhat cautious, you envisioned a 30% work from home rate longer term, which is about double what the government is estimating. Why is that figure so high?
Yeah.
And what does that tell us?
Yeah, so our surveys right now suggest that our surveys of households suggest that we've got about 50% working from home right now. So we are assuming that it comes down substantially from where it is today, because many folks will be going back to work or having some more flexible, at least, work from home and arrangement and not full-time work from home. But that we do end up with double the amount that the government had estimated pre-COVID, that was existing pre-COVID. Now, what have we done? We've proven that productivity does not suffer when we work from home. We've removed the stigma of working from home. We've put in the technological advances to be able to work from home, and that will continue to deepen over time. When we took a deep dive into more than 700 sectors of the economy to look at the capability to work from home, it gives you these types of numbers.
Yeah.
And getting this estimate, you know, just a ballpark of it right, is important, because if we think about consumer spending trends, when we work from home, we spend like we're in retirement. So if we take out healthcare spending, which is more age-related, when we move into retirement, we drop apparel expenditures by 20%, we drop food away from home by 8%, and we drop transportation expenditures by 4%. So all of those are tied to work, commuting, eating out, and purchasing work clothing. And so that's also important to understand work from home, because it will shift consumer spending patterns.
No, I'm so glad you brought that up. I thought this was sort of one of the more interesting takeaways, which is that people who work from home effectively spend like they're retired, minus healthcare, you know, which again is a big piece of this when you are retired. But what does that mean for the population longer term, and for all of those sectors, you know, apparel, food away from home, transportation? If you effectively have the population behaving like it's retiring early on a scale that we would have previously thought unimaginable.
Yeah, so it means a lot of shifts that will have to happen. I mean, drawing in the analysis of our equity analysts, you know, we have to think about shifts like single-family rentals, which we had identified as a tailwind from the demographic changes last year, but this accelerates that. So very longer-term tailwinds for that. Think about food delivery and third-party aggregators. Think about online gaming, telehealth. Not just work from home impacting commercial real estate, but telehealth impacting real estate as well. It's got a broad range of impacts across a broad number of sectors. And the major themes that we have to think about is e-commerce, e-services, experiences and travel, tech enabling transformation, and social reallocations. Those are all wrapped up in things that could be affected by these post-COVID shifts.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and it goes right back to all the stocks that are outperforming right now and the changes underway. Ellen, thanks so much. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
Ellen Zentner is Morgan Stanley's chief U.S. economist. Coming up, it's a blow to Disney as the company is forced to push back its park reopenings and potentially its movie releases, too. We've got the details and what it means for the bottom line. Plus, putting the market in supermarket. Albertsons is set to make its public debut finally after a failed attempt in 2015. Why now? And is the stock a buy? Remember, you can always watch or listen to us live on the go on the CNBC app. The Exchange is back in a couple.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Welcome back. Let's get right to Rahel Solomon for our CNBC News update. Hi, Rahel.
Hi, Kelly. Here's what's happening at this hour. Let's start in New York City, where the city is set to move into phase three of its reopening plan as early as July 6th. This is according to the mayor, Bill de Blasio. The city will allow indoor service at restaurants and reopen recreational areas and personal care businesses like nail salons. And this summer, drivers are likely to pay less for gas than they have in 4 years. That is according to the latest forecast from AAA. Prices are likely to average $2.25 per gallon nationwide. That is a 15% decrease from last summer. Future Hall of Famer Vince Carter officially retiring now after 22 seasons in the NBA. The eight-time All-Star is leaving the game as the league's 19th all-time leading scorer. And the Philly fanatic and Mr. Met, well, they are back in play. Major League Baseball will allow mascots in the ballpark, but not on the actual field. And this is a reversal of a previous plan that banned them entirely. But with no fans in the stands, the mascots will be performing only for the TV cameras. So, Kelly, as a Philadelphia native, I have a soft spot in my heart for the fanatic. He once kissed me, stole a kiss, mind you, on live TV. So he knows how to play to the cameras.
I can't believe this is a national story.
Very important.
Yeah.
And you are up to date, Kelly.
We want all those things that make us feel like we're getting back to normal.
I know.
But we'll keep him away from you. Rahel, thanks so much. Coming up, the shutdowns across the country are causing another consumer icon to file for bankruptcy. We'll have those details. And getting back to campus, colleges are beginning to announce their plans for the fall as they face rising costs to keep campuses safe and declining admissions. We'll speak with Bowdoin College about their plans and who's not coming back to campus ahead. Welcome back. Markets volatile today as concerns about the coronavirus and the reopening of the economy persist. We have the Dow up only 19 points right now. All the major averages are clinging on to tiny gains, although, again, the Nasdaq is looking at its ninth positive session in 10 right now. Let's get to some of the biggest movers of the day. Julia Borson is looking at the delays in the reopenings of Disney's California parks. Dom Chu is here to break down KB Home's tough second quarter. Leslie Picker has a look at the Albertsons IPO. And Kate Rogers is covering the latest restaurant to declare Chapter 11. Julia, let's start with you.
Well, Kelly, Disney delaying reopening its Anaheim theme parks, which was set for July 17th. This is the company waits for guidelines from the state. Disney saying, quote, given the time required for us to bring thousands of cast members back to work and restart our business, we have no choice but to delay the reopening of our theme parks and resort hotels until we receive approval from government officials. Now, Governor Gavin Newsom saying he, quote, appreciates Disney's responsiveness to his concerns about reopening amid the recent increases in COVID-19 infections. This comes after unions representing 17,000 Disneyland employees wrote to Governor Newsom, raising safety concerns about opening the park. Now, one more park update. Disney announcing it's switching its Splash Mountain rides to a Princess and the Frog theme from a theme around Song of the South, further distancing Disney from the racially insensitive 1946 film. Kelly?
Julia, but it was the Florida parks we were speaking about yesterday where the workers are petitioning to delay that opening?
Yeah, so there have now been over 8,000 people who have signed a petition saying in Florida they believe that the park should not reopen until we see a decline in the number of COVID cases. Clearly, Kelly, that's not what we're seeing. But what is happening right here is we're really seeing a difference between the way the state of Florida and the state of California are handling things. Florida was full steam ahead, ready to open the parks. That park is scheduled to open, still on track to open July 11th. The California parks, that was scheduled to start around July 17th. But one thing I want to note here that's different is that in Florida, Disney has already opened the mall outside of the park, and they're already starting to have people come in there, giving them a much better sense of not only consumer demand, but also how people and employees are handling the logistics of it all.
All right. But now, as you said, the California one delayed. Julia, thanks very much, Julia Boorstin. Let's turn now to shares of KB Home falling today by 15%. They're off the lows. They're down about 11% right now. All of this after surprisingly weak second quarter numbers. Dom Chu has the breakdown for us. Dom?
All right. So what we have are earnings that were actually better than expected for KB Home. And that was perhaps one of the drivers behind some of the optimism for a whole lot of home builders that were they going to make more money. So the earnings were actually a beat. However, revenues did come in below analyst estimates. Now, one of the big reasons why traders were a little bit less enthralled had to do with the order cancellations, because they had a lot of people canceling their orders for new homes because of the COVID-19 pandemic and concerns around those. When you see that kind of activity, could the trends be sustained? That's something to watch there. But if you're looking for the silver lining, that was earlier in the quarter. So far in June, you are seeing some better trends in terms of orders for KB Home. That's why people are a little bit more skeptical about whether or not some of these declines today have to do with just the earnings report. Look at this in context. This is KB Home over the last year and one of the ETFs that tracks home builders. You can see a sharp move higher for both of these particular groups since the COVID-19 lows, reflecting, Kelly, some of that optimism. Still, though, the home builders, one of the hottest parts of the market since the COVID-19 lows in March. That's the reason why perhaps you're seeing an outsized pullback today.
Yeah, the cancellations were surprising, Dom, but maybe the theme is, you know, the people who are ordering new homes now, we know that they're doing so in spades. These are new people with, you know, I mean, that's offsetting the ones who unfortunately had to cancel.
Sure. And the cancellations, by the way, they might be specific to certain geographies, certain parts of the market. One of the other things I would note, though, in that hot home builder trade is not just the home builders themselves. Check out some of these stocks here as well. You're talking about Masco, which makes Delta faucets. Sherwin-Williams makes paints. Whirlpool for appliances. You can see a lot of that price action since those COVID lows have reflected some of those moves higher and the general sense, Kelly, that things are getting better and that the housing market will improve as a result. So not just the home builders, watch these stocks in the ancillary as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Dom, thanks very much. Let's turn to the Albertsons IPO. If it sounds familiar, well, we've heard this before, but they are expected to price after the bell tonight. They tried to go public 5 years ago and failed. Let's bring in Leslie Picker with the latest now. Leslie?
Hey, Kelly, that's right. It's a bit of a deja vu here. And if you haven't heard of the grocery store Albertsons, you may know its other brands like Acme, Safeway, and Randall's. The company is aiming to price shares of its long-awaited IPO tonight after two unsuccessful attempts in recent years. In 2015, Albertsons filed all of its paperwork, but ultimately investors balked at its $12 billion debt load. The company then tried again 3 years later with a merger with publicly traded Rite Aid, but shareholders opposed that combination. So here we are in June of 2020 in the middle of a pandemic where demand for groceries is higher and the company's debt load is lower, and Albertsons private equity owners may finally get to cash out, including Cerberus, which first invested in Albertsons 14 years ago. Albertsons still, though, has about $8 billion in debt and won't be receiving any proceeds from the IPO to help pay that down, Kelly.
What do you, they're not going to get any proceeds from the IPO, or they're
nope.
just not? Why not?
Nope. Only the current investors are getting to sell their shares this time around. So only in the ECM equity capital markets world, that's known as secondary shares that are being offered. No primary shares that will go to the company. But they could raise money in a secondary offering
sure.
in the future. But this time, just the private equity owners.
Fascinating. I didn't realize they owned Acme. It's the only grocery store in town that's open past 8 p.m.
All about New Jersey
days.
Grocery stores.
Exactly. Leslie, thanks very much. Leslie Picker with the rundown there. And finally, Chuck E. Cheese's parent company is filing Chapter 11 as it struggles during the ongoing pandemic. Kate Rogers has the sad details. Who could be next, Kate?
Hey, Kelly. Well, CEC Entertainment filing for Chapter 11 as the pandemic has really rocked business. Of course, CEC is the parent company of the iconic Chuck E. Cheese and Peter Piper Pizza, and about one-third of its 700 locations have reopened. Last quarter, same-store sales fell by 22%, but CEC says it's not throwing in the towel. It'll use Chapter 11 to restructure its balance sheet and support reopening efforts and long-term strategy. PE firm Apollo Global Management bought the company, taking it private about 6 years ago. Chuck E. Cheese is not a traditional casual name, as it does have the entertainment aspect of the business, more like a Dave and Buster's, which could potentially be in trouble as well. But it's notably the first big restaurant name to declare bankruptcy in the pandemic. Of course, we've seen major retailers like J. Crew and JCPenney leading the pack on that. Kelly, back over to you.
You know, it's not surprising because obviously Chuck E. Cheese's feels like it's been out of date for quite some time. The locations I know around us are, you know, not the best, but Dave and Buster's felt like it was the up and comer. I mean, it had that great real estate. It, you know, for years, it was a great stock. But maybe they still face the same headwinds if we're going to be looking at an environment like this for quite some time.
That's right. RJ Hottovy of Morningstar says the more experiential you are, like a Chuck E. Cheese or a Dave & Buster's, the more at risk you could be. He does note Dave & Buster's got a $100 million cash infusion back in May, so they do have a bit of a lifeline. Two other names that he did mention, though, Dine Global and also Red Robin Gourmet Burgers. But casual in general, Kelly, has been struggling for some time, and the pandemic could really be the nail in the coffin for a lot of these companies.
Yeah, but such a reversal. Experiential was the way of the future, not anymore, at least for now. Kate, thanks so much. Kate Rogers with the rundown there. And coming up, it's getting back to campus for some. It's lower tuition for those who aren't returning and no varsity sports. These are just some of the steps Bowdoin College is taking in the fall to keep students safe. The president of the school joins us next. Colleges across the country are releasing their reopening plans for the fall semester, including the protocols they'll put in place to keep everyone safe. According to the Wall Street Journal, that cost could be in the millions for some schools as they upgrade systems, invest in safety equipment and testing. Not only that, but many colleges are going to great lengths to maintain social distancing. Joining me now with a look at their plans is Clayton Rose, the president of Bowdoin College. President Rose, it's great to have you. Welcome.
Great to be here, Kelly. Thank you.
And you guys are able to at least try to get students on campus because you're a pretty remote, sort of tight-knit community there. But it's only going to be the freshmen for the fall. Is that right?
We'll be anchored by our first-year class, but we'll also have a group of students for whom trying to learn at home is virtually impossible because of the home conditions, a group of seniors who are working on honors projects that require them to be on campus, and our residential life staff.
And you're going to flip-flop that so then the freshmen learn at home in the spring semester, maybe try to bring the seniors back?
So our goal is to learn as much as we can in the fall with the group that we're going to have about how to safely run our campus. And then if we do that properly, which is my expectation, and the world cooperates a little bit with us, then we will bring our seniors, juniors, and sophomores back in the spring, and hopefully also have an opportunity for our athletes in the winter and spring sports to participate in those sports as well.
Right, because there won't be any fall athletics. And, I mean, this is interesting to me as well that you say, you know, not only will all students and residents be required to use face coverings, maintain social distancing, you say everyone on campus will be tested for the virus at least twice weekly. Sounds uncomfortable, by the way. I think, you know, based on how those tests work, but we can understand why you're doing it, and required to participate in contact tracing. Tell me about the cost of all of this, because around here we have, you know, colored wristbands and you get your temperature checked every day. I mean, it's a big undertaking.
It is. And in order to keep, so let me make a couple of comments about that. College campuses in this country are densely packed environments. And for most of the time, that's a wonderful thing. It's all kinds of goodness that comes out of that in a college experience. But when you've got a public health crisis and a highly contagious virus like the one that we're dealing with now, having that kind of density is really problematic. So we're reducing the density on our campus, and then we're putting in place, as you've said, a set of safety practices. The requirement that everyone indoors and most of the time outdoors wear face covering, good hygiene practices, social distancing, symptom monitoring, and so forth. But we've also learned through the reopening of America in the last 5 or 6 weeks that following those practices in a rigorous way for anybody, college students and everybody else, is really hard to do. We've seen that, and we've seen the consequences of that. And so one of the other things that we're doing is putting in place this testing protocol. We're going to test everybody twice a week, everybody on our campus. It is a program that we're participating in with a scientific institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's an easy-to-use test. It's the front of the nose, not the very invasive tests that were in the early days. We get a very quick turnaround. The tests are highly reliable. And given the length of time it takes to be able to, from the time that someone acquires a virus to the time they become communicable, this allows us one or two turns at testing individuals to capture that virus early, and then to figure out where we might have had a breakdown in those practices through contact tracing to be able to fix the systems that we've got in place during the fall to make them stronger so that we're in a better position to bring back a larger number of students in the spring and ultimately get to the full number. And so we've got to work those systems. And the fall could be tricky from a scientific and health perspective. And so we're very mindful of that as well.
Oh, sure. And you're fortunate, like I said, because you can at least try to go this route. Many of your more urban campuses with different arrangements, or colleagues, I should say, in the Northeast, you know, don't feel like they can even give it a shot at all. But I want to ask you just again about the financials before we have to go here. You're freezing tuition based on last year's rates, I understand it. No room and board if you're not on campus, obviously. But what's the financial hit been like for the college, including the cost of all of this new infrastructure?
So we're very fortunate, Bowdoin, to be in very strong financial condition. We have a very strong endowment. We have a lot of liquid cash reserves with which to deal with a situation like this. The plan that we've put in place, where we're only bringing back some of our students, is actually the costliest plan that we could have done. If we brought everyone back, we would have captured more of the comprehensive fee, and we're all of our employees will be and faculty will be on campus and will be employed. So this is actually the costliest plan, but one that we are able to, fortunately, to be able to weather through some sacrifice by folks on campus. We haven't been able to fully add up everything that this is going to cost, but it will run into the millions for us between the testing, the work that we're going to do around online learning, and in order to do it right and to protect the health and safety of the community, that kind of investment is what's required, and to deliver a great education at the same time.
Yes, oh that too. Clayton Rose, thank you so much for joining me. Best of luck with it.
Thank you, Kelly.
He is the president of Bowdoin College in Maine. Still ahead, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio saying the pandemic could force the city to lay off 22,000 workers. We're going to look at what the ongoing economic fallout in states and cities could mean for the muni bond market next. Cities and states across the country are having to make tough choices amid the coronavirus budget crisis. Putting infrastructure projects on the back burner is one of them. For more on that, let's bring in Elon Moy. Elon?
Well, Kelly, this is where the rubber literally meets the road. 65% of cities are either delaying or even canceling infrastructure projects. That's according to a survey out this week by the National League of Cities. A slightly smaller percentage say they're holding off on buying new equipment. Now, part of the problem these localities are facing is that they're seeing a drop off in revenue from the gas tax, tolls, vehicle registration and titling. Those are often major sources of funding for public works projects. Now, in Chattanooga, the city relies on taxes from hotels and motels. Now that that's dropped off, the city is scrapping plans to rebuild its popular skate park. It's foregoing a new fire truck worth $1 million, and it's stopping work on the iconic Walnut Street Bridge.
These are huge expenditures that involve a lot of time and effort. And if we don't have the money, we just don't have the money.
The Treasury Secretary said that infrastructure is not going to be part of the next relief package. But Kelly, Chattanooga's mayor told us that they could get ready to be started tomorrow.
Wow. Elon, I mean, that no fire truck, I mean, no skate park. But it is interesting how quickly, as much as we talk about infrastructure time and again, and whether we're going to have a big package, it's not happening.
Yeah, and these are sort of the concrete examples of the ways that the state budget crisis is really going to be felt by a lot of the residents of these towns.
Absolutely. Elon, thanks very much. Elon Moy with the latest there. Cities and states are stuck in a vicious cycle of mounting expenses and steep budget shortfalls. What does it mean for the muni debt market? Here to make sense of this, Nisha Patel is director of municipal portfolio manager at Parametric, an Eaton Vance company. And Tom Koslick is head of municipal strategy and credit at Hilltop Securities. Welcome, both of you. Nisha, I'll start with you. You know, yields are surprisingly low still in many cases. We've got the Fed support, but is this a major problem brewing?
It is. And I think, you know, the good news is that the states have come in with record reserve levels, generally for the most part, record tax collections. And so financially, most of these states and municipalities have come in a much stronger kind of financial footing. However, now as they really draw down those reserve levels, start realizing a pretty decent loss on the revenue side, you know, there's going to be more support that's needed. So through the CARES Act, some of the states have already received some funds. The Fed has set up the municipal liquidity facility, which, you know, based upon the rates, it's more of a penalty for high-grade issuers, but that is kind of the last resort should any municipalities need to tap into any capital.
And Tom, issuance is surging, right? I mean, just as it is with companies who are looking for cash to get through the pandemic, so are cities and towns.
Yeah, I think that there's actually been less issuance so far this year than what we were expecting to see. But let me add on to what we you were just referring to with regard to the overall financial backdrop, because I think that's really important. It's not just infrastructure that's being put on hold. We're seeing a significant amount of budget shortfalls at the state level, $600 billion of budget shortfalls at the state level. The local governments are seeing almost $400 billion of revenue shortfalls. And just through April, state and local governments already laid off more individuals than they did in the entire wake of the Great Recession. And we did see $150 billion of direct aid in the CARES Act for state and local governments, but that's nowhere near enough. And the state and local governments need more unrestricted direct relief.
Why is it that issuance has been a little light or on the light side of what's expected? And Tom, what's your advice for investors who are saying, you know, I'm looking for yield somewhere, you know, especially at triple tax advantage? What do you tell them?
Yeah, so one of the reasons that there has been less issuance so far is because there was a good two, maybe 3 weeks through in March into April when issuance, there were only a few deals actually that priced. But then finally, when we got to the point where maybe mid-April, the market normalized and issuance started up again. Let me get to your question about kind of where investors can look with regard to sectors. You know, for me, the most vulnerable sectors right now are the sectors that really are relying on more narrow security pledges or economically sensitive security pledges. I think that there are going to be like senior living projects, retirement facilities, mass transit, those types of things. But one of the things that I warn about investors to do is I don't think that you need to throw every single issuer out in a specific sector. For example, airports, the Moody's median days cash on hand for airports was almost 700 days. And so that tells us that even though airports are really looking at some hard times right now, there are a lot of airports that really position themselves very well.
That's fascinating. Nisha, 10-second answer. What's your favorite pick in the muni space?
I would say the healthcare space is looking to be pretty interesting. And I say that because, of course, you want to play defensive in this environment. But we've seen a pretty significant spread widening, recent tightening, but still fairly wide relative to pre-crisis levels. So
yeah.
I think if you opportunistically, there's some good value there.
Fascinating. Thank you both. Nisha Patel, Tom Kozlik, talking through one of the hardest hit spaces, municipal bond market. That does it for The Exchange.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.